Good morning. Nancy Collins here on behalf of Ezekiel Watkins. And if I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. In this case, the police improperly elicited custodial statements without timely and effective Miranda warnings. These circumstances were particularly inadequate for Mr. Watkins, who is substantially cognitively impaired. The belated Miranda waiver obtained during interrogation did not adequately apprise him of his rights, undermining the warning is contrary to Miranda and to Siebert versus Missouri. Stepping through the various components of this, first, Mr. Watkins was in a custodial setting when he was interrogated at the police station. You look to the circumstances of the questioning. He was in a small, windowless room in a police station, locked behind a locked door, surrounded by police, at least guarded by at least one police officer throughout, if not two. He was, during the course of the hour and 40 minutes of the interview that happened before he was given his Miranda warnings, he was caught in lying to the police about his phone contact with Ms. Chow. He was pressed to tell the truth, told that the police know the answers already to these questions, and therefore would be catching him in his lies.
At what point did it become custodial? He was invited there. He sat down. He was told he was free to leave. He was told how to leave. The door was not locked from his side to go out, as far as I know.
He was told he was free to leave, but not told that the door was not locked from the inside. It was locked for him to get into the room, and he was not explained, well, those locks don't work in reverse. But he was told only one time at the outset of the interview. And our position is that it's custodial from the outset, but at the very latest.
But if we don't agree with that, when did it change to being custodial?
At the very latest, at 12:18, which is 20 minutes before the Miranda warnings were given, by that time he had been caught in lying to the police about his telephone contact with Ms. Chow during the time of the incident. And these various things had happened about them being told that they know the answers, that he's lying. They bring in the shovel wrapped in evidence tape. This is over an hour into this interview, which shows to be a sort of increasingly accusatorial, increasingly that the police have evidence incriminating him and he's not going to be free to leave. And a reasonable person in that scenario, after an hour plus of being caught hindering essentially a police investigation by lying to them. Then a few minutes later at 12:22, he admits burying her body with a shovel. At that point, he's admitted to a crime. It's certainly a crime to bury someone's body with a shovel in a public park. But it's still another, it's not until 12:38 where the Miranda warnings were given. So in that time frame, at the very least, those final 20 minutes of that pre-warned interrogation is custodial, and Miranda warnings should have been given then. The warnings themselves, when delivered, are not, as our U.S. Supreme Court said in Siebert, not a ticket to admissibility. Siebert addressed a problem that the courts had seen developing where police deliberately delay giving Miranda warnings in an effort to undermine their effectiveness. The Supreme Court said that's not acceptable, that it violates Miranda to do so because you're not giving what Miranda contemplates to be the effective appraisal so a free, rational choice can be made by the suspect.
What happened in the intervening 15 to 20 minutes after he admitted to burying the body with a shovel?
Then he's pressed for further details describing the incident itself, initially saying he talks about the knife that he had, that he displayed, or that he brought out. And ultimately, by the point where he gets Miranda, it's after he admits that she died by his knife that he had stabbed her. Further details are elicited immediately thereafter where he incriminates himself all the more. But by that point, he had confessed. He had admitted to participating in her death. And that's before he gets the Miranda warnings. And it's at that point where the trial court said, well, he's not in custody until that actual confession is elicited and they give him his warnings.
But up until that point, he was representing that she had injured herself with his knife.
Yes, that she had injured herself. And then he admits to having done it, but said it was an accident.
What case do you think this is most factually like, where, this kind of alleged tactical sort of interrogation is thought to be in violation of Miranda.
Well, I mean, I think that the Siebert case is very instructive because it was a similar delayed warning scenario where they wait until they get a confession. Although in Siebert, there is actually a break taken, so the Miranda, there is a 20-minute break taken, so there was some sort of separation, but a majority of the Supreme Court said that that's not enough to establish the ability to really understand and effectively decide, because the warnings are under ineffective when you're only told in this sort of minimized way in this continuing interview. And here they say, just so you're aware, just so you know, let me just tell you these rights. And as you already know, this is voluntary, reading through them orally. And, you know, as we know, and the other issue here is the voluntariness of Mr. Watkins' subjective understanding of those rights, given his cognitive problems.
Well, it seems like part of the analysis that we have to go through is, so Siebert has been discussed in this case, in the Hickman case.
Yeah.
And so in that case, the suspect was subject to custodial interrogation before the Miranda warnings were given. And is that an important distinction from this case?
That would
say to us, well, we're not going to follow that.
Well, I don't think it's a critical distinction because of the nature of this, the very long time that Mr. Watkins, for over an hour 40 minutes, is there, pressured and questioned about this incident, caught in those lies. That renders it the. That demonstrates that those delayed warnings and the way they were given in this, just so you're aware, let me tell you this, and let's go back and backtrack and have you repeat everything. And one thing that Siebert says is,
in order to apply Siebert and particularly Justice Kennedy's concurrence, which says that it's infrequent, do we have to be able to say from the record that this was a deliberate interrogation strategy?
Justice Kennedy says that deliberate, but it was a purposeful delay. So yes, that would be part of it. But we do have testimony here that of the planning, that the foreplanning that went into this interrogation. Let me just get.
Do we have a finding from the trial court that this was or was not a deliberate strategy?
The judge did not speak one way or the other to that. There's no firm finding, but there is testimony in the record about how they planned the room.
Was that argued to the judge that there should or should not be a finding about that?
I don't think the finding itself was argued, but this case, the Siebert case, was
right.
Discussed.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Donna Wise, representing the state of Washington. The issue in terms of when Miranda must be presented to a defendant, to a suspect, is whether a reasonable person would have felt their freedom was curtailed to a degree associated with formal arrest. So that's the question here. Not did he feel like he should talk to the police, not was he intimidated by the police, but when was he in custody? And as you pointed out, this defendant had previously had contact with the police about Kathy Chow when she was just a missing person. He had come into the same room previously, the previous April, talked to the police for a long period of time, was let go. He was told on this day, well, he was told 6 days before this, these three interrogations, he was told 6 days before the police would like to talk to him. He said, gee, I'm not available for 6 days. They said, fine, come on in. We'll make an appointment 6 days from now. He voluntarily comes to the station, is interviewed in the same room.
What about counsel's point that 20 minutes before he was given his Miranda warnings, it was clear to him as well as everybody that he had confessed to a crime, maybe not the crime that they were hoping to get him to confess to and hadn't yet gotten him to confess to, but definitely he knows that he's involved in criminal activity, and contrary to any idea he might have had that this was simply another little chat, you know, they're on him.
Well, all we've established at that point is that he helped bury the victim's body.
And a reasonable person feels free to leave an interrogation room when they've confessed that to the police, that he's been involved in illegal activity with a corpse.
When they've been told they're free to leave, yes. And He, as the judge found, he was the closest person to the door. No one had said he couldn't leave. In fact, he understood that he could leave. Even after he was advised of his Miranda rights, he told the police when he agreed to take the police to the burial site, he said, gee, I don't know if that's going to work. I need to be at work at 4 o'clock. That's what the defendant said. And then later on, when his coworker called him, he said, gee, it was almost 4 o'clock at the time of this second statement.
Well, that kind of gets into his mind rather than what an objective person would think, doesn't it?
Well, what would a reasonable person think if they were told they were free to leave? And this is what the trial court concluded. The defendant was told he was free to leave. He'd been allowed to leave before. And there was no, as I believe the court said, there was nothing prior to the Miranda warnings that would give a person a reasonable belief they would not be free to go. That was the trial court's finding.
So I guess that's the point where I'm just trying to bear down a little bit here. Nothing had happened, but the argument is that something did happen, namely that the session with the police intensified to the point where they're now getting him and have gotten him to confess to criminal.
Well, he hasn't confessed to anything. I want to emphasize that again. All he said was, I helped bury the body. And what he says is, yeah, she was waving the knife around, and I may have, I believe he says, triggered, what is it he says here? I guess I accidentally triggered the knife to go the wrong way, possibly stabbing her neck. That's when he was given advice with Miranda rights. So the rule that the counsel is suggesting is that whenever a person who's being questioned says something that's incriminating, Miranda warnings must be given. That's not the rule. Oregon versus Elstead,
the
U.S. Supreme.
I wonder if you would address now the Siebert issue.
Mm-hmm. And
it does seem as though the point of Siebert is that when there is a deliberate strategy, and when the strategy is let's get him to confess, and then we'll give him Miranda, and then we'll go back over it again, and now that he's already confessed to it, now he's told he could have a lawyer. It's sort of confusing. It's like, why are we going over this? Why do we have to go over this again since we already went over it once?
Well, the rule of Missouri.
I mean, that is the point, isn't it, of Siebert?
No.
Okay. What's wrong about
it? No, Your Honor. What's wrong with it is what the court pointed out earlier. What Siebert prohibits is a deliberate choice not to give Miranda warnings when they're required, when a person is in custody, and then to get statements from that person and then later on Mirandize them. So that's not what happened in this case. What counsel is suggesting is whenever, there's a chance that a defendant might say something incriminating, you can't question them at all without giving them Miranda. That's not the rule, and that's not what Missouri v. Siebert says. Missouri v. Siebert doesn't say if a person has said something incriminating, then a later advice of Miranda rights is ineffective. That's not what Missouri v. Siebert says. Those cases, and Hickman, Williams, talk about a person who was in custody, and the police deliberately chose not to give Miranda advice, got incriminating statements.
Was that the case in Siebert also?
Yes.
So that's the critical distinction.
Exactly.
That you're relying on.
In fact, I was directing the court earlier to Oregon versus Elstead because it talks about the difficulty for police in figuring out when a person is in custody, and that's why their statements made. Assuming that police make a mistake in deciding when custody occurred, statements made after Miranda advice is given are still admissible because it's hard to tell when custody.
Could I ask you about another issue since time is
sure.
short? There's this issue of the Privacy Act, and I understand that there's a couple different sections of it, but my question really is he wasn't told that there was a video going on, only audio, and the audio taping was conducted in such a way that he could see that at some points it was being turned on and at some points it was being turned off. And but he didn't know that there was an audio tape going on the whole time. Was the audio tape, by the way, the video, was it accompanied by its own audio or was it solely video?
I believe it was also audio taping, Your Honor, because that's what
was shown.
There
was a misrepresentation to him from all appearances as to what was actually going on. And I'm just wondering why that was done. I mean, I realize that the way it turned out, the trial court applied the law in such a way as to exclude the video, I gather, because it had not been, his consent had not been obtained. Is that right?
No, the video recordings were played for the jury.
Oh, they were.
The defendant was told he was being recorded, and in fact, if you look at the testimony from the defense attorney who spoke to the defendant that night, the defendant pointed out that there was a camera there. So
he did know it.
He knew there was a camera there. The state just didn't litigate that because the state didn't care about the statements he made at the times when the small recorder were turned off. The only person that, the only party that admitted any of those statements was the defense.
Okay. And then one other question.
But the court excluded the state from offering those.
No, the court didn't rule on it, Your Honor, because the state said it did not intend to offer. So the court just didn't rule on that Privacy Act issue. It wasn't necessary.
Yeah. Let me ask you about the warrant. We have a warrant that has this language in it that is somewhat vague. Let's see. You can seize items such as specific items of clothing, a knife with a camouflage handle, a pickaxe, and then any other item that detectives reasonably believe may be associated with this crime. And I gather, if I'm correct, that they went in and served the warrant and then came up with a diary.
A journal, yeah.
Is that right, a journal? So how is that to be explained?
Well, before we go any further on this, Your Honor, I did want to make sure the court understood my reliance on the fact that this language was only in one search warrant and not in both search warrants. Counsel, in reply brief, relies upon citations to the record, which are citations to the affidavit in support of the search warrant. This language only appears in one search warrant, and that is the search warrant in the family home.
So is this not the warrant which produced the journal?
That is the warrant that produced the journal. I just wanted to clarify that fact, Your Honor.
Okay.
But the I'm sorry.
I'm asking because, you know, the journal is sort of one of the most sensitive type of items that you can search for. And it seems a little hard for me to jump from a camouflage knife to a journal. If the police are in there and they're looking around for stuff that looks like it might be associated with the crime, it seems, unless, you know, you have more to add, that they're riffling around. You know, they're rooting around and looking at stuff that they weren't really authorized to look at.
Well, they were authorized to look all around the room because they were authorized to look for dominion and control documents, which would include written documents. And what the trial court found was that this journal, which had on the cover drawings and the name of the defendant's current girlfriend, Jamie, mm-hmm. and the homicide was committed in order to make the current girlfriend happy and get rid of the problem that Kathy Chow had become. So
they knew that at the time.
It was clear at that point that it was relevant as evidence of the crime. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a couple of little factual things that just came up. One is that Ms. Wise said that Mr. Watkins was aware that there was a video recording. I don't see that in the record. It's not my recollection of it. My notes indicate he told the lawyer who at arraignment or he met with right after he was arrested that he gave three statements. There was no audio. It turned itself off or they turned it off or something like that. I think it was pretty clear from the record that there was a hidden video and audio recording equipment in the room. The police instead used this pretend tape recorder to say, oh, speak loudly. This is the only little thing that's recording you. When in fact, it was more for show. There was video and audio he didn't know about.
You say it was a pretend tape recorder. Aren't those the tapes that were played at trial?
It was my understanding that it was the recording equipment in the room that they used. And because they did turn that off at times, but kept recording him, so some of those things that came in were through that other recording, and that was the whole transcript is the recording of the room and not the little thing.
The state pointed out there was objection to using the video. The state did not offer the portions from when the audio digital recorder was turned off.
That's correct. That's correct. That's true. And it's not, obviously, the primary issue in the case is the rest of the statement and not those parts of it.
Under those facts, why would we suppress everything that occurred in the room? It was not a private conversation.
And that's what it lynches on. I mean, if the statute, if the Privacy Act 973030, if it is a private conversation, if this is this casual conversation, it's not formal, that's not custodial in any way, and it's private, then that does require, under our case law, the more stringent suppression. Otherwise, it wouldn't require that kind of suppression.
You're saying that you can be having a private conversation with a uniformed police officer, somebody who...
Well, they were plainclothes detectives.
Well, I know, but I mean, he knew they were police officers.
Yes.
They were not confidential.
Yes. Yeah, that is our argument on that point.
What?
That he was having, that it was essentially a private conversation, and that part of the statute would apply given how it was presented to him.
Authority for that? I mean, the law was that if you're talking to a policeman, it's not private.
In the Lewis case, they were traffic police, you know, stopping them on the street. They said, well, that's obviously not private. Because you're being, you know, you're driving, they're having this conversation with you about you're following the law. That statute would apply to Mr. Watkins only to the extent that you find that he was being misled about the circumstances of his interview, that it was a casual conversation, that it was simply talking about, you know, a missing person, and it wasn't intended to be any sort of official proceeding.
Well, that kind of runs afoul of your argument.
And obviously, it's not both ways, but that is our position on that point. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.